Due to the extreme nature of this programme, listener discretion is advised. The subject matters may include topics of substance usage, sex, historical events that may be sensitive to some listeners, and foul language. Things discussed may not be considered politically correct in this overly sensitive environment. They may not be appropriate for listeners under the age of 13. As well as some listeners may find things offensive no matter the age, again, listener discretion is advised.
Greetings and salutations, and welcome to the next episode of GXO, Generation Extraordinary, the podcast nobody asked for. Focusing on everything that's relevant to the greatest generation alive today, Generation X. So if it involves movies, music, TV, and a bit of history from 1960 through 1999, we're going to talk about it. Who knows? You might just learn something before it's all said and done. And if you're lucky, this grouchy old fart might just regale you with a story or two. I'm Robert Popp, coming to you from beautiful Podunk, Nebraska.
This portion of the show is brought to you by GXO Tour and Travel, booking trips to areas that aren't as bad as what you've heard.
Discover Sydney, Australia, from the safety of the Hotel Koala, because everything in Australia is just waiting to kill you, from swimming in the harbor to trekking the outback. However, if you don't heed the warning and you do venture out, we have some of the best hospitals you will find anywhere. And for the family who is waiting for you to recover, we offer some of the best shopping, theaters, and dining ever designed into an emergency room. Standing beautifully restored today, the Hotel Koala offers warm, personalized service and a unique blend of urgent care charm and contemporary comforts. The Koala, where old-world charm and modern medicine meet perfectly together. To book your stay at the Koala, contact Amanda Hump or Stella Virgin, part of our expert team at GXO Tour and Travel.
The views and opinions expressed are just that, Rob's views and opinions. He is not always politically correct, and they may not match up with your own opinions. It is not his intentions to offend anyone. Hopefully you find the shows entertaining and informative as well. Please note, Rob is not a professional historian, but he has done a lot of research for this show. With that being said, mistakes happen, but he will do his best to minimize those. Keep in mind, Rob is just some nut with a microphone.
Hello, I am the voice of GXO Artificial Intelligence. Yes, I sound like Rob, mainly because the lazy fucker needed me for when he is sick or just pooped, like he is this week being tired and sick after his daughter's wedding last weekend. By the way, congratulations to Ariel and Cam. But as you may already know, Rob has been battling some virus, or it might be allergies, it might be a summer cold, or who knows, it might be malaria. In any case, Rob has been nursing a sore throat and resting his voice this week, so I will be giving you the details on today's topic. I hope you enjoy. As Rob would say, greetings and salutations, and welcome to this week's episode of GXO Generation Extraordinary, the podcast nobody asked for. This week we are headed to the year 1994, and we will discuss the Rwandan genocide. Here is our history lesson for that year. World leaders at the time. In Russia, the Soviet Union General Secretary of the CPSU, Boris Yeltsin. In South Africa, State President Frederick Willem de Klerk, until May 10th then, President Nelson Mandela from May 10th. Here in the United States, President Bill Clinton, and I know you are disappointed Rob is not here to do his really bad impression. And finally, in the United Kingdom, Prime Minister John Major. Top headlines for 1994. Olympic figure skater Nancy Kerrigan was attacked. Eventually, three were arrested in the attack. Tanya Harding wins the National Figure Skating Championship title, but is stripped of her title following the attack on her rival, Nancy Kerrigan. That gave a whole new meaning to taking a knee or, as in the Karate Kid, sweep the leg. South Africa holds its first multiracial elections and triumphs in first multiracial elections. And in May, Nelson Mandela becomes president of South Africa. Channel Tunnel opened on May 6th between England and France. Serbia continues attacks on Bosnia. First genetically engineered tomatoes available use of GM foods in U.S. is approved. The German luxury car manufacturer BMW announces the purchase of Rover from British Aerospace. 48 members of the Order of the Solar Tradition cult commit suicide to escape the hypocrisies and oppression of this world. I wonder when crap like this will start happening again, seeing what kind of shitstorm the world is in right now. O.J. Simpson flees police in his white Ford Bronco in the slowest speed chase in California. Later, O.J. Simpson is arrested in killings of his estranged wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her, hard air quotes, friend, Ronald Goldman, Major League Baseball Players Association begin 232-day strike causing 1994 season to be canceled. PLO leader Yasser Arafat returns to Palestine after 27 years in exile, North Korea. Tensions over inspections of nuclear plants increase. The Seongsan Suspension Bridge over the Han River in Seoul collapses, killing 32. Well, that sucks. The Italian cruise ship Achille Lauro is destroyed during a fire off the coast of Somalia. Russian President Boris Yeltsin orders tanks and troops into the rebel region of Chechnya to restore order. Way to go, Boris. New Sunday trading laws allow shops in Britain to open legally on Sundays. Fred West, serial killer, together with his wife, Rose West, was responsible for the murder of at least 12 young women, including their own children. Rob did some research on these two pukes, and wow, it's seriously a fucked up story. He swears he is going to do a special on them, but we will see. Ayrton Senna of Brazil, age 34, is tragically killed during the San Marino Grand Prix in Imola, Italy. The journal Nature reports the finding in Ethiopia of the first complete Australopithecus afarensis skull. The Whitewater scandal investigation begins, and this is where the start of several sex scandals involving Slick Willie. Four terrorists are convicted in World Trade Center basement bombing. Fucking terrorists. Notable deaths that year, Kurt Cobain kills himself. Yeah, right. He was 27, which he'll be discussing later. John Candy, old Uncle Buck passed. Burt Lancaster, Raul Julia, Peter Cushing, Telly Savalas, George Peppard from the A-Team, Jessica Tandy from Driving Miss Daisy, Claude Akins, Cesar Romero, Joker from the Adam West Batman series, Dick Sargent, he was the second Darren on Bewitched, William Conrad, Sorrell Brooks, Roscoe's fat little buddy from the Dukes of Hazzard, Diana Shore, Cab Calloway and Henry Mancini, Harry Nielsen, he was a singer, Jackie Kennedy Onassis, former First Lady, former President Richard Nixon, Jeffrey Dahmer, John Wayne Gacy, Andre Chikatilo, Russian serial killer. It was a bad year for serial killers. Cost of living in 1994, average cost of new house, $119,050. Average monthly rent, $533. Cost of a gallon of gas, $109. Loaf of bread, $159. Dozen eggs, 86 cents. In the music store, top five songs in the U.S., The Sign by Ace of Base, I Swear by All for One, The Power of Love by Celine Dion, Stay, I Missed You by Lisa Loeb and Nine Stories, Don't Turn Around by Ace of Base, top R&B songs, Creep by TLC, great song, Before I Let You Go by Blackstreet and On Bended Knee by Boyz II Men. I love that song. I'll Make Love to You by Boyz II Men. Top country songs, Pickup Man by Joe Diffie, That is a great song. Too bad Joe is gone now. Ugh. Not a Moment Too Soon by that fucking Tim McGraw. Take Me As I Am by Faith Hill. And according to Rob, these last two are the reason country music changed to more pop. Fucking Tim McGraw. Fucking Faith Hill. Baby Likes to Rock It by the Tractors. I still love that song. I wonder what ever happened to the Tractors. And Kick a Little by Little Texas. Top One Hit Wonders of 1994. Here Comes the Hot Stepper by Eni Kamoze. Short Dick Man by 20 Fingers featuring Gillette. Tootsie Roll by 69 Boys. Cantaloupe Flip Fantasia by US3. And by Crash Test Dummies. On the crime beat, so Kurt Cobain supposedly kills himself. He was 27. Now, I need to preface this by stating I'm not really a Nirvana fan or a Cobain fan, but his death intrigues me. This last April 5th, 2024, marked the 30th anniversary of his death, although there are still many theories as to what really happened, and yes, I will be touching on five of the more popular ones. But until that, these are the official facts leading up to the event. Following a tour stop at Terminal 1 in Munich, Germany, on March 1, 1994, Cobain was diagnosed with bronchitis and severe laryngitis. He flew to Rome the next day for medical treatment and was joined there by his wife, Courtney Love, on March 3rd. The next morning, Love awoke to find that Cobain had overdosed on a combination of champagne and Rohypnol. Cobain was rushed to the hospital and was unconscious for the rest of the day. After 5 days, Cobain was released and returned to Seattle. However, Cobain's wife, Courtney Love, later confirmed that the overdose had been a suicide attempt by stating, quote, "He took 50 pills. He probably forgot how many he took. But there was a definite suicidal urge to be gobbling and gobbling and gobbling." On March 18, 1994, Love phoned the Seattle police, informing them that Cobain was suicidal and had locked himself in a room with a gun. Police arrived and confiscated several guns and a bottle of pills from Cobain, who insisted that he was not suicidal and had locked himself in the room to hide from Love. Love arranged an intervention regarding Cobain's drug use on March 25, 1994. The 10 people involved included musician friends, record company executives, and one of Cobain's closest friends, Dylan Carlson. Cobain reacted with anger, insulting and heaping scorn on the participants, and locked himself in the upstairs bedroom. However, by the end of the day, Cobain agreed to undergo a detox program, and he entered a residential facility in Los Angeles for a few days on March 30, 1994. On April 1, 1994, Cobain left the rehabilitation center he had checked into 2 days before, Exodus Recovery Center, by scaling a 6-foot wall. On April 2nd, Cobain took a taxi to a Seattle gun shop where he purchased and received a receipt for shotgun shells. Cobain told the taxi driver he wanted to buy shells because he had been burglarized. Most of Cobain's friends and family were unaware of his whereabouts. On April 7th, amid rumors of Nirvana breaking up, the band pulled out of the 1994 Lollapalooza Festival. On April 8th, Cobain's body was discovered in the greenhouse above the garage at his house by Vika Electric employee Gary T. Smith, who arrived that morning to install security lighting. Smith initially thought Cobain was asleep until he saw blood coming out of Cobain's ear. He also found a suicide note with a pen stuck through it inside a flower pot. It was addressed to Cobain's childhood imaginary friend, Boda, that stated that Cobain had not felt the excitement of listening to as well as creating music, along with really writing, for too many years now. Cobain's body had been there for days. The coroner's report estimated he died on April 5, 1994, at the age of 27. That's really a fucked up deal. But here are the five main conspiracy theories about Kurt Cobain's death. Mind control, one of the strangest theories. It is said that the musician was a victim of mind control and was forced to commit suicide. Accident. Others claim that Cobain's death was an accident. This theory is based on the idea that Cobain accidentally injected himself with an overdose of heroin. Government conspiracy. It is also suggested that Cobain's death was part of a government conspiracy to silence him. The idea arises because Cobain was a symbol of the counterculture, and the government wanted him dead. Assisted suicide. It is believed that Cobain did not commit suicide, but was helped to die by someone else. The idea arises because Cobain was too depressed to kill himself. And murder. Some believe that Cobain was murdered by Courtney Love, his wife at the time. This theory is based on several alleged inconsistencies at the crime scene, such as the position of Cobain's body and the amount of heroin in his system. The book, Who Killed Kurt Cobain? The Mysterious Death of an Icon, explores the premise that the death of Kurt Cobain, frontman of American rock band Nirvana, was a case of murder and not suicide. It is a collaborative investigative journalism book written by Ian Halperin and Max Wallace. It went on to be an international bestseller. The book explores the theory that Cobain's wife, Courtney Love, had been involved in his death and that he died of a heroin overdose before being shot, contrary to the official police report that he died from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. The authors present evidence from Tom Grant, who was the private detective initially hired by Love to monitor Cobain, as well as a man named El Ducci, who claims he was hired to kill Cobain. The latter claimed that he was offered $50,000 to kill Cobain and allegedly passed a lie detector test in this statement that was carried out by the world's top polygraphist. The second edition of the book, released in 2000, also details how Love tried to stop the book being released, as well as trying to stop the 1998 documentary Kurt and Courtney, which also explores the possibility that Cobain's death was murder, not suicide. Personally, I think the puke Courtney Love killed him, mainly cause I can't stand her. But if I take a step back, I think somebody killed him. And there are the inconsistencies that lead me to think this. The first to object publicly to the report of suicide was Seattle Public Access host Richard Lee, stating there were several discrepancies in the police reports, including several changes in the nature of the shotgun blast. He claimed on a video acquired showed a marked absence of blood for what was reported as a point-blank shotgun blast to the head. Tom Grant, a private investigator hired by Love to find Cobain after rehab, said he believes that Cobain was murdered. Grant was still under Love's employment when Cobain's body was found. Grant has stated that he finds the events surrounding Cobain's death to be filled with lies, contradictions in logic, and countless inconsistencies motivated by profit over truth, as well as a web of business deals and personal career considerations. Courtney Love, her lawyers, and many of Courtney's industry supporters have engaged in an effort to keep the public from learning the real facts of this case. Grant asserts that Cobain could not have injected himself with such a large dose of heroin and still have been able to pull the trigger. Another component is Grant's belief that Cobain's note was doctored to make it only appear to be a suicide note. A third component is the purported lack of fingerprints from Cobain or others at the scene. He also asserts that Love had financial motivation to kill Cobain, both in the form of rumors that Cobain was planning to divorce her and the fact that Cobain had turned down an offer to headline the 1994 Lollapalooza Festival for nearly $10 million. In studying the Rome incident, journalists Ian Halperin and Max Wallace contacted Dr. Osvaldo Galletta, who treated Cobain after the incident. Galletta contested the claim that the Rome overdose was a suicide attempt. "We can usually tell a suicide attempt. This didn't look like one to me," said Galletta, who also contradicted Love's claim that 50 Rohypnol pills were removed from Cobain's stomach. Halperin and Wallace mused, "Grant believes Courtney may have mixed a large number of pills into Kurt's champagne so that when he took a drink, he was actually unknowingly ingesting large amounts of the drug enough to kill him. But if that's the case, why did she call the police when she found him unconscious on the floor? If she wanted Kurt dead, why didn't she just leave him on the floor until he died?" Based on evidence gathered in interviews, Halperin and Wallace believe that Cobain wanted to divorce Love near the time of his death and that she was looking for a vicious divorce lawyer to help crush a prenuptial agreement she had reportedly signed that would keep their respective fortunes separate in the event of divorce. They also made the case that because Nicholas Hartshorn, the coroner in Cobain's case, was an admitted friend of Love's, that this was a conflict of interest. Their initial book, Who Killed Kurt Cobain, was released in 1999 and drew a similar conclusion to Broomfield's film. While there wasn't enough evidence to conclusively prove foul play, there was more than enough to demand that the case be reopened. A notable element of the book included their discussions with Grant, who had taped nearly every conversation he had undertaken while he was working for Love. Over the next several years, Halperin and Wallace collaborated with Grant to write a second book, 2004's Love and Death, The Murder of Kurt Cobain. Some of Cobain's friends and family members believe Cobain was murdered. Hank Harrison, Courtney Love's father, has shared his belief that Love had a motive. "There is evidence of foul play, and the case should be reopened." Cobain's grandfather, Leland Cobain, also publicly stated that he believed Cobain was murdered. I mentioned a few books, but I'll leave it up to you, murder or suicide. In the movie theater, Ace Ventura, Pet Detective. God, I hate that fucking movie. The Air Up There. Angels in the Outfield. Good movie. Baby's Day Out and Bad Girls. Blank Check. Blown Away. City Slickers. To Legend of Curly's Gold. Clean Slate. Clerks. Fuck Yeah. Jay and Silent Bob. Hell Yeah. Karina Karina. Crooklyn. The Crow. D2, The Mighty Ducks, Dumb and Dumber, another fucking movie I can't stand, Ed Wood, The Flintstones, Forrest Gump, I love that movie. It's one of my go-to movies when there is nothing else on. Four Weddings and a Funeral. Guarding Tess, The Hudsucker Proxy, IQ, Interview with a Vampire. It Could Happen to You. It's Pat, Junior. Legends of the Fall, Lion King, Lowdown Dirty Shame, Major League 2, The Mask, Maverick, I liked Maverick for that matter, I still do, Milk Money, Muriel's Wedding, Natural Born Killers, Nell, Pulp Fiction, Quiz Show, Return of Jafar, Richie Rich, Serial Mom, The Shadow, Speed, The Pagemaster, The Santa Claus, The Shawshank Redemption, Get Busy Living or Get Busy Dying, Star Trek Generations, that was fucking awesome, Time Cop, True Lies, Wolf, that was a shitty movie, Wyatt Earp, which was the Wish version of Tombstone. On TV, we had the option to watch Real Monsters, The Adventures of Timmy the Tooth, The Bozo Super Sunday Show, The Brothers Grunt, Bump in the Night, Chicago Hope, The Critic, Duckman, Ellen, Essence of Emerald, Loved Emerald, Bam, Friends, Gargoyles, Inside the Actor Studio, Lonesome Dove, The Series, The Magic School Bus, My So-Called Life, Party of Five, Sisters, Sisters, Space Ghost Coast to Coast, Spider-Man, Street Sharks, Sweet Valley High, Thunder in Paradise, The Tick, Touched by an Angel, Viper, Weird Science TV Series, and our topic for today, the Rwandan genocides. So stick around after the words from our fake sponsors.
This portion of the show is brought to you by GXO Tour and Travel. Booking trips to areas that aren't as bad as what you've heard.
Welcome to Arkansas, where visitors can enjoy water sports like kayaking, canoeing, and floating on the White River. Not only are the water sports spectacular, the fishing is world class. Whether looking to land striper, trout, walleye, or a huge catfish, the waters in the mountain home area are always stocked. Come take time to relax and enjoy what we have to offer and to be part of our down-home family. And see, we ain't all backwards-ass country fucks. To book your trip to Arkansas, contact Ben Dover or Andy Kornholer, part of our expert team at GXO Tour and Travel.
Any claims of time travel are purely fictitious and are only meant for entertainment purposes. And honestly, if you believe Rob can travel through time, I only have one question for you. What the hell is wrong with you?
Warning! The following topic today is very disturbing. It may be triggering for some listeners, and it may not be appropriate for listeners under the age of 18, and some listeners may be disturbed by the content today. No matter the age, I completely understand if you shut today's GXO off. It's not going to offend me. If you must go, go, and we will see you next time. Content today includes torture, rape, murder, genocide, and political issues and beliefs. Okay? The reason I wanted to cover this actually this year marks the 30th anniversary of this horrific event, and it is one that really sticks out to me. There is so very much to the events leading up to this, but I am going to condense of what happened. The Rwandan genocide, also known as the genocide against the Tutsi, occurred between April and July 1994 during the Rwandan Civil War. During this period of around 100 days, members of the Tutsi minority ethnic group, as well as some moderate Hutu and Twa, were killed by armed Hutu militias. In 1990, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, a rebel group composed mostly of Tutsi refugees, invaded northern Rwanda from their base in Uganda, initiating the Rwandan Civil War. Over the course of the next 3 years, neither side was able to gain a decisive advantage. In an effort to bring the war to a peaceful end, the Rwandan government, led by Hutu President Juvenal Habyarimana, signed the Arusha Accords with the RPF on August 1993. The catalyst became Habyarimana's assassination, 6th April 1994, creating a power vacuum and ending peace accords. Genocidal killings began the following day when majority Hutu soldiers, police, and militia murdered key Tutsi and moderate Hutu military and political leaders. The scale and brutality of the genocide caused shock worldwide, but no country, let me say that again, no country intervened to forcefully stop the killings. Most of the victims were killed in their own villages or towns, many by their neighbors and fellow villagers. Hutu gangs searched out victims, hiding in churches and school buildings. Sexual violence was rife, with an estimated 250,000 to 500,000 women raped during the genocide. The RPF quickly resumed the civil war. Once the genocide started and captured all government territory, ending the genocide and forcing the government and genocidaires into Zaire, now the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The genocide had lasting and profound effects. In 1996, the RPF-led Rwandan government launched an offensive into Zaire, home to exiled leaders of the former Rwandan government and many Hutu refugees, starting the First Congo War and killing an estimated 200,000 people. Today, Rwanda has two public holidays to mourn the genocide, and today, genocide ideology and divisionism are criminal offenses. The ethnic identities of the Hutu and Tutsi were reshaped and mythologized by the colonizers. Christian missionaries in Rwanda promoted the theory about the Hamitic origins of the kingdom and referred to the distinctively Ethiopian features and hence foreign origins of the Tutsi. These mythologies provide the basis for anti-Tutsi propaganda in 1994. In 1973, brought President Juvenal Habyarimana to power. In the early years of Habyarimana's regime, there was greater economic prosperity and reduced violence against Tutsis. In October 1990, Habyarimana and the hardliners, government officials who were anti-Tutsi, exploited the fear of the population to advance an anti-Tutsi agenda, which became known as Hutu power. Tutsi were increasingly viewed with suspicion. A pogrom was organized on 11 October 1990 in a commune in Gisenyi province, killing 383 Tutsi. A group of military officers and government members founded a magazine called Kangura, which became popular throughout the country. This published anti-Tutsi propaganda, including the Hutu Ten Commandments, an explicit set of racist guidelines, including labeling Hutus who married Tutsis as traitors. In 1992, the hardliners created the Coalition for the Defense of the Republic, the CDR Party, which was linked to the ruling party but more right-wing, and promoted an agenda critical of the president's alleged softness with the RPF to make the economic, social, and political conflict look more like an ethnic conflict. The president's entourage, including the army, launched propaganda campaigns to fabricate events of ethnic crisis caused by the Tutsi and the RPF. The process was described as mirror politics, whereby a person accuses others of what the person himself or herself actually wants to do. Following the 1992 ceasefire agreement, a number of the extremists in the Rwandan government and army began actively plotting against the president, worried about the possibility of Tutsis being included in government. Habyarimana attempted to remove the hardliners from senior army positions, but was only partially successful. Akazu affiliates remained in powerful posts, providing the hardline family with a link to power. Throughout 1992, the hardliners carried out campaigns of localized killings of Tutsi, culminating in January 1993, in which extremists and local Hutu murdered around 300 people. In February 1993, it cited these killings as the primary motive, but its effect was to increase support for the extremists amongst the Hutu population. From mid-1993, the Hutu power movement represented a third major force in Rwandan politics, in addition to Habyarimana's government and the traditional moderate opposition. Apart from the CDR, there was no party that was exclusively part of the power movement. Instead, almost every party was split into moderate and power wings, with members of both camps claiming to represent the legitimate leadership of that party. Even the ruling party contained a power wing, consisting of those who opposed Habyarimana's intention to sign a peace deal. Several radical youth militia groups emerged attached to the power wings of the parties. These included the Interahamwe, which was attached to the ruling party, and the CDR's Impuzamugambi. The youth militia began actively carrying out massacres across the country. The army trained the militias, sometimes in conjunction with the French, who were unaware of their true purpose. In 1990, the army began arming civilians with weapons such as machetes, and it began training the Hutu youth in combat officially as a program of civil defense against the RPF threat. But these weapons were later used to carry out the genocide. Rwanda also purchased large numbers of grenades and munitions from late 1990. In one deal, future Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali, in his role as Egyptian foreign minister, facilitated a large sale of arms from Egypt. In March 1993, Hutu power began compiling lists of traitors whom they planned to kill, and it is possible that Habyarimana's name was on these lists. The CDR were publicly accusing the president of treason. During 1993, the hardliners imported machetes on a scale far larger than what was required for agriculture, as well as other tools which could be used as weapons, such as razor blades, saws, and scissors. These tools were distributed around the country, ostensibly as part of the civil defense network. In October 1993, the president of Burundi, Melchior Ndadaye, who had been elected in June as the country's first ever Hutu president, was assassinated by extremist Tutsi army officers. The assassination sparked the Burundi civil war between Burundi's Hutu and Tutsi and the Burundi genocide, with 50,000 to 100,000 people killed in the first year of war. The assassination caused shockwaves, reinforcing the notion among Hutus that the Tutsi were their enemy and could not be trusted. General Roméo Dallaire sent his genocide fax to headquarters. The fax stated that Dallaire was in contact with a top-level trainer in the cadre of Interahamwe Armed Sikh Militia of MRND. The informant, now known to be Mathieu Ngirimpatsi's chauffeur, Kassim Turatsinze, a.k.a. Jean-Pierre, claimed to have been ordered to register all Tutsi in Kigali. According to the memo, Turatsinze suspected that a genocide against the Tutsis was being planned, and he said that in 20 minutes his personnel could kill up to 1,000 Tutsis. Dallaire's request to protect the informant and his family and to raid the weapons. On 6 April 1994, the airplane carrying Rwandan President Juvenal Habyarimana and Cyprien Ntaryamira, the Hutu president of Burundi, was shot down as it prepared to land in Kigali, killing everyone on board. Despite disagreements about the perpetrators, many observers believe the attack and deaths of the two Hutu presidents served as the catalyst for the genocide. Following Habyarimana's death, on the evening, a crisis committee was formed. It consisted of Major General Augustine Ndindiliyimana, Colonel Teoneste Bagosora, and a number of other senior army staff officers. The committee was headed by Bagosora, despite the presence of the more senior Ndindiliyimana. Prime Minister Agathe Uwilingiyimana was legally next in the line of political succession, but the committee refused to recognize her authority. Roméo Dallaire met with the committee that night and insisted that Uwilingiyimana be placed in charge, but Bagosora refused, saying Uwilingiyimana did not enjoy the confidence of the Rwandan people and was incapable of governing the nation. The committee also justified its existence as being essential to avoid uncertainty following the president's death. Bagosora sought to convince UNAMIR and the RPF that the committee was acting to contain the presidential guard, which he described as out of control, and that it would abide by the Arusha Agreement. UNAMIR sent an escort of 10 Belgian soldiers to Prime Minister Uwilingiyimana with the intention of transporting her to the Radio Rwanda offices to address the nation. This plan was canceled because the presidential guard took over the radio station shortly afterward and would not permit Uwilingiyimana to speak on air. Later in the morning, a number of soldiers and a crowd of civilians overwhelmed the Belgians guarding Uwilingiyimana, forcing them to surrender their weapons. Uwilingiyimana and her husband were killed, although their children survived by hiding behind furniture. The following day, soldiers, police, and militia quickly executed key Tutsi and moderate Hutu military and political leaders who could have assumed control in the ensuing power vacuum. Hutu civilians were recruited and encouraged to arm themselves with machetes, clubs, blunt objects, and other weapons, and encouraged them to rape, maim, and kill their Tutsi neighbors, and to destroy or steal their property. On 9th April, unobservers witnessed the massacre of children at a Polish church in Gikondo. The same day, 1,000 heavily armed and well-trained European troops arrived to escort European civilian personnel out of the country. The troops did not stay to assist UNAMIR. Hutu gangs searched out victims hiding in churches and school buildings and massacred them. Local officials and government-sponsored radio incited ordinary citizens to kill their neighbors, and those who refused to kill were often murdered on the spot. Either you took part in the massacres, or you were massacred yourself. In another case, thousands sought refuge in the official technical school in Kigali, where Belgian UNAMIR soldiers were stationed. On 11th April, the Belgian soldiers withdrew, and Rwandan armed forces and militia killed all the Tutsi. One such massacre occurred at Nyarubuye. On the 12th April, more than 2,000 Tutsis sought refuge in a Catholic church in Nyange, then in Kivumu commune. Local Interahamwe, acting in concert with the authorities, used bulldozers to knock down the church. The militia used machetes and rifles to kill every person who tried to escape. Pope John Paul expressed his deep concern about what was happening in April 1994. On 9th of April, in a message to Rwandan Catholics, he urged them not to give way to feelings of hatred and revenge, but to courageously practice dialogue and forgiveness. The Catholic Church affirms that genocide took place, but states that those who took part in it did so without the permission of the Church. Though religious factors were not prominent, in its 1999 report, Human Rights Watch faulted a number of religious authorities. In Rwanda, including Catholics, Anglicans, and other Protestant denominations, for failing to condemn the genocide, though that accusation was belied over time. Many other clergymen gave their lives to prevent Tutsis from being killed. However, some clergy participated in the massacres. Catholic nuns Maria Kisito and Gertrude Mukungango were convicted in 2001 of involvement in the murders of 500 to 700 Tutsis who had sought refuge at their convent in Sovu. Witnesses testified that they had directed a death squad to the victim's hiding place and had given them petrol with which to burn down the building. In 2006, a local priest, Father Athanase Seromba, was sentenced to 15 years imprisonment, increased on appeal to life imprisonment, by the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda for his role in the massacre of 2,000 Tutsis. The court heard that Seromba lured the Tutsis to the church, where they believed they would find refuge. When they arrived, he ordered bulldozers should be used to crush the refugees, who were hiding inside the church, and if any of them were still alive, Hutu militias should kill them all. March 2017, Pope Francis acknowledged that while some Catholic nuns and priests in the country were killed during the genocide, others were complicit in it and took part in preparing and executing the genocide by succumbing to hatred and violence. He further asked for forgiveness for the church's role and its inaction, and said the sins and the failings of the church and its members had disfigured the face of Catholicism. And as a member of the church, I am disgusted by the actions of these horrible examples. Please don't judge the whole of a religion and the few who don't follow its teachings. Rape was used as a tool to separate the consciously heterogeneous population and to drastically exhaust the opposing group. The use of propaganda played an important role in both the genocide and the gender-specific violence. The Hutu propaganda depicted Tutsi women as a sexually seductive fifth column in league with the Hutu's enemies. The exceptional brutality of the sexual violence, as well as the complicity of Hutu. Women in the attacks suggest that the use of propaganda had been effective in the exploitation of gendered needs, which had mobilized both females and males to participate. Soldiers of the Army for the Liberation of Rwanda and the Rwandan Defense Forces, including the Presidential Guard, and civilians also committed rape against mostly Tutsi women. Although Tutsi women were the main targets, moderate Hutu women were also raped, along with Hutu women who were married to or who hid Tutsis were also targeted. During the conflict, Hutu extremists released hundreds of patients suffering from AIDS from hospitals and formed them into rape squads. The intent was to infect and cause a slow, inexorable death for their future Tutsi rape victims. Tutsi women were also targeted with the intent of destroying their reproductive capabilities. Sexual mutilation sometimes occurred after the rape and included mutilation of the vagina with machetes, knives, sharpened sticks, boiling water, and acid. Men were also the victims of sexual violation, including public mutilation of the genitals. Some experts have estimated that between 250,000 and 500,000 women were raped during the genocide. During the remainder of April and early May, the Presidential Guard, Gendarmerie, and the youth militia, aided by local populations, continued killing at a very high rate. The goal was to kill every Tutsi living in Rwanda, and with the exception of the advancing rebel RPF army, there was no opposition force to prevent or slow the killings. The domestic opposition had already been eliminated, and UNAMIR were expressly forbidden to use force except in self-defense. In rural areas where Tutsi and Hutu lived side by side and families knew each other, it was easy for Hutu to identify and target their Tutsi neighbors. In urban areas where residents were more anonymous, identification was facilitated using roadblocks manned by military and Interahamwe. Each person passing the roadblock was required to show the national identity card, which included ethnicity, and any with Tutsi cards were killed immediately. Many Hutu were also killed for a variety of reasons, including alleged sympathy for the moderate opposition parties, being a journalist, or simply having a Tutsi appearance. thousands of bodies were dumped into the Kagera River, which ran along the northern border between Rwanda and Uganda and flowed into Lake Victoria. This disposal of bodies caused significant damage to the Ugandan fishing industry as consumers refused to buy fish caught in Lake Victoria for fear that they were tainted by decomposing corpses. The RPF was making slow but steady gains in the north and east of the country, ending the killings in each area occupied. The genocide was effectively ended during April in areas of Ruhengeri, Byumba, Kibungo, and Kigali. The killing ceased during April in the Akazu heartlands of western Ruhengeri and Gisenyi, as almost every Tutsi had been eliminated. Large numbers of Hutu in the RPF-conquered areas fled, fearing retribution for the genocide. 500,000 Kibungo residents walked over the bridge at Rusumo Falls into Tanzania in a few days at the end of April and were accommodated in United Nations camps effectively controlled by ousted leaders of the Hutu regime, with the former prefect of Kibungo in overall control. In the remaining prefectures, killings continued throughout May and June, although they became increasingly low-key and sporadic. Most Tutsi were already dead, and the interim government wished to rein in the growing anarchy and engage the population in fighting the RPF. 23rd June, around 2,000 soldiers entered southwestern Rwanda as part of the French-led United Nations Operation Turquoise. This was intended as a humanitarian mission, but the soldiers were not able to save significant numbers of lives. The genocidal authorities were overtly welcoming of the French, displaying the French flag on their own vehicles, but killing Tutsi, who came out of hiding seeking protection. In July, the RPF completed their conquest of the country, with the exception of the zone occupied by Operation Turquoise. On 18th of July, the genocide was over, but as had occurred in Kibungo, the Hutu population fled en masse across the border, this time into Zaire, with Bagosora and the other leaders accompanying them. The succeeding RPF government claims that 250,000 people were killed in the genocide, 94% of whom were Tutsi, thousands of widows, many of whom were subjected to rape, became HIV positive. There were about 400,000 orphans, and nearly 85,000 of them were forced to become heads of families. An estimated 250,000 Rwandans, mostly Hutu, were displaced and became refugees. Most of the victims were killed in their own villages or in towns, often by their neighbors and fellow villagers. The militia typically murdered victims with machetes, although some army units used rifles. During these events, and in the aftermath, the United Nations and countries, including the United States, the United Kingdom, and Belgium, were criticized for their inaction and failure to strengthen the force and mandate of the United Nations Assistance Mission for Rwanda peacekeepers. Intelligence reports indicate that United States President Bill Clinton and his cabinet were aware before the height of the massacre that a deliberate and systematic genocide to eliminate all Tutsis was planned. Fear of a repeat of the events in Somalia shaped United States policy. At the time, with many commentators identifying the graphic consequences of the Battle of Mogadishu as the key reason behind the United States' failure to intervene in later conflicts such as the Rwandan genocide. After the battle, the bodies of several United States casualties of the conflict were dragged through the streets of Mogadishu by crowds of local civilians and members of IDID's Somali National Alliance. According to the former United States Deputy Special Envoy to Somalia, Walter Clark, the ghosts of Somalia continue to haunt us our lack of response. In Rwanda was a fear of getting involved in something like a Somalia all over again. President Clinton has referred to the failure of the U.S. government to intervene in the genocide as one of his main foreign policy failings, saying, "I don't think we could have ended the violence, but I think we could have cut it down, and I regret it." In her 2004 book, Linda Melvern documented that in the 3 years from October 1990, Rwanda, one of the poorest countries in the world, became the third largest importer of weapons in Africa, spending an estimated $112 million. She cited a significant contract with Egypt in 1992, and with France and South Africa the next year, before the international embargo against Rwanda. A 1994, South Africa and France were two of the main suppliers of arms to Rwanda. According to Human Rights Watch, after the embargo, they diverted their arms trade through Goma Airport in Zaire. Zaire played a key role in supplying arms and facilitating arms flows to the Rwandan army. Some officials also encouraged arms trafficking by private dealers. The infrastructure and economy of the country had suffered greatly during the genocide. Many buildings were uninhabitable, and the former regime had carried with them all currency and movable assets when they fled the country. Human resources were also severely depleted, with over 40% of the population having been killed or fled. Many of the remainder were traumatized. Most had lost relatives, witnessed killings, or participated in the genocide. The long-term effects of war rape in Rwanda for the victims include social isolation, sexually transmitted diseases, unwanted pregnancies and babies, with some women resorting to self-induced abortions. The systematic destruction of the judicial system during the genocide and civil war was a major problem. After the genocide, over 1 million people, nearly one-fifth of the population remaining, were potentially culpable for a role in the genocide. The RPF pursued a policy of mass arrests for those responsible and for those persons who took part in the genocide, jailing over 100,000 people in the 2 years after the genocide. The pace of arrests overwhelmed the physical capacity of the Rwandan prison system, leading to what Amnesty International deemed cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment. The country's 19 prisons were designed to hold about 18,000 inmates. In 1998, there were over 100,000 people in crowded detention facilities across the country. Government institutions, including judicial courts, were destroyed, and many judges, prosecutors, and employees were murdered during the genocide. By 1997, Rwanda only had 50 lawyers in its judicial system. These barriers caused the trials to proceed very slowly, with 130,000 suspects held in Rwandan prisons after the genocide. 349 cases were handled between 1996 and the end of 2000. Of those defendants, 20% received death sentences, 32% received life in prison, and 20% were acquitted. It was calculated that it would take over 200 years to conduct the trials of the suspects in prison, not including the ones who remained at large. Meanwhile, the United Nations established the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, ICTR, based in Arusha, Tanzania. The United Nations Tribunal tried high-level members of the government and armed forces, while Rwanda prosecuted lower-level leaders and local people. The number of Tutsi survivors of the genocide has been debated. Different figures between 150,000 and 3,000 to 500,000 have been offered. There are a number of organizations representing and supporting these survivors of the genocide. In all, number of survivors, very vulnerable survivors, 120,080, shelterless, 39,685, orphans living in households, headed by children, 28,904, widows, 49,656, disabled during the genocide, 27,498, children, and youth with no access to school, 15,438, graduates from high school with no access to higher education, 8,000. There was a movie that starred Don Cheadle called Hotel Rwanda from 2004 that was a true story. Paul Rusesabagina's experience encouraged director to produce the film. A paperback novel published by New Market Press titled Hotel Rwanda, bringing the true story of an African hero to film. It tells the story in a docudrama format. If you have never seen it, please seek it out and keep in mind it is a true story. Thanks for listening this week. I know this was a pretty heavy topic this week, but to give you fair warning, next week isn't going to be any lighter. I'm going to be talking about the Cuban Missile Crisis, which took place in 1962. So until then, have a great week.
This has been Generation Extraordinary. The views and opinions are Rob's and Rob's alone. Any claims of time travel are purely fictional. The music and audio clips are not Rob's or GXO's, and in most cases were downloaded through his paid YouTube subscription and are only used for entertainment purposes. GXO is a production of Popeye Enterprises. Its host, creator, producer, and editor is Robert Pop. Co-producer is Harley Quinn. If you are a fan of the show, please show your support by going on to Spotify and follow us, like and share. It seems like such a small thing to do, but it really does help. For more information, support, suggestions, or to contact us, go to the website www.genxord.com. Thanks for listening.